From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time for All Tech Considered. Over the weekend, we were turning back the clock on our bedside tables, also on the microwave, the oven, the car. Good thing cell phones can adjust to daylight saving time on their own. We are surrounded by clocks. It seems they're built into every digital gadget and machine, and that has led to a decline in wristwatch sales. But as NPR's Sarah Gonzalez reports, the centuries-old time-telling tool is making a comeback.
Walking into the It's About Time shop in Alexandria, Virginia, is a little like stepping into the past, into Geppetto's workshop, a small, crammed space completely filled with clocks and clock tools, grandfather clocks, cuckoo clocks, watches from World War II, the hour strikes, and... It's not a common sound anymore, but the melodies in here are easier on the ears than some of today's time indicators. That noise may make you feel like you need to just get up and be somewhere, but making your appointments on time wasn't the idea behind the first mechanical clocks in the 1300s. Stephen Halter is the owner of the clock shop. He says back then you'd just agree to be somewhere by mid-morning.
You didn't have to be someplace at 10 a.m. exactly or you'd be fired. You know, it was time was considered a general idea.
Halter says we began personalizing time in the late 1800s with the wristwatch, and that little trinket led to a society that works and lives around the strictures of a clock, says Bob Price. He's a sociology professor at Texas State University, where he teaches the course Technology and Society.
I often start by saying, okay, examine your physical person. What machines have you strapped to your body? The clock is the only device so culturally central that we treat it that way, that we strap it onto our wrist.
And why we now embed time into every machine, he says.
I walk into the kitchen and there's a clock in the oven and the microwave. They're everywhere. I get into the car and there's a clock. I'm listening to NPR on the way in and they're telling me the time repeatedly. You can't get away from it.
The novelty of tech accessories is starting to wear off. And the fashion watch buyer for Macy's, June Ray, says wristwatch sales are actually on the rise.
The overall watch business and the watch industry has been experiencing an unusual growth. It's explosive. People who've been in this industry for 20, 30 years have never seen numbers like this.
Ray says the old time-telling technology is the it accessory of the year. 17-year-old Aria Brown and a crowd of friends are at Pentagon City Mall in Washington, D.C. Brown says teens are only going for one type of watch.
A big, bulky, waterproof watch in all colors, clear, pink, blue, yellow, orange, black, whatever.
With a thick band and a large faceplate, she says it's the style right now. But that alone doesn't really make her buy watches.
It would have to be a really, really cute watch because it's a waste of money when I really have my cell phone already.
The wristwatch isn't just about fashion, but it isn't just about time anymore either. Fashion and luxury watchmakers are having to update their technology to compete with all the new gadgets. They're adding new functions like GPS capabilities and moving to solar-powered batteries to give the old wristwatch that modern edge. Sarah Gonzalez, NPR News.
Now a story about tech, tarts, and copyright infringement that's triggered outrage. Cook's Source, a Sunderland, Massachusetts-based food magazine, published a story about the evolution of the apple pie for its October issue. It appears with the byline Monica Gaudio. Problem was, the story was lifted from another website without Gaudio's knowledge. When Gaudio discovered what had happened, she asked Judith Griggs, the editor of Cook's Source, for an apology. Griggs replied with a, "My bad," but added this, "The web is considered public domain, and you should be happy. We just didn't lift your whole article and put someone else's name on it." Well, for some clarification on copyright law, we turn to intellectual property lawyer Margaret Escanay. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa.
What about that argument that Judith Griggs is making? Anything on the web is public domain. True or false?
False. Public domain has a very particular meaning in copyright law, and it basically means that the work is free to use for anyone to do anything with without paying any sort of royalty. And so what is in the public domain is very limited and is also governed by the law. And it's generally speaking things that are quite old. Anything written in the last 10, 15, 20 years, virtually impossible to be in the public domain.
Now, this publication, Cooksource, which publishes both an actual magazine and online, takes material or took material from all kinds of places, including from NPR. And NPR has now filed a cease and desist letter on that. Is this a common thing? Do you see this a lot, especially on the web, where it seems like it's kind of a lot of the time it's a conglomeration of all kinds of stuff from different sources?
It is an incredibly common thing on the web. And it is very difficult for copyright owners and authors to police. But yes, there is a culture on the internet of borrowing from here or there or taking a piece from this and commenting on this. And there is a fine line between taking a small bit of something, a piece of music, a piece of writing, and using that sort of as a launching point to create your own authorship, your own work, your own commentary, and the idea of taking something wholesale without really adding more to it that has a lot of value.
And for people who are publishing online, what steps would they take to protect themselves for something like this?
The first step that I would generally suggest to clients is make sure that your copyright notices are appropriately done on your work. So anytime you put something up on your website, you put that C in a circle in your name so that people recognize that you, in fact, are asserting rights in the work. And secondly, if you feel that the work is valuable to you, then go ahead and take advantage of the copyright registration system that the U.S. government has set up through the Copyright Office.
In this case, with the original writer, Monica Gaudio, she asked for an apology, a printed apology, which she did not get. She also asked Cooksource to donate $130 to Columbia Journalism School. She also didn't get that. But what she did get in the end was essentially a shaming in the public square on the web.
As a copyright lawyer, I think that's very interesting because in my experience, there's been this sort of almost cultural shift saying everybody owns everything and everything online is for free. The fact that this happened, I think, is actually very interesting, and it shows that maybe there's a bit of a turning point that people are beginning to understand that authors should get compensated for what they create.
Okay, Margaret Escanay, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Margaret Escanay is an intellectual property lawyer here in Washington with the firm Finnegan. You're listening to NPR.
Now to New Orleans, where a federal judge has created a security zone around BP's collapsed oil rig. It's the legal equivalent of taking yellow police tape and draping it around the watery crime scene. In this case, the potential crime involves the catastrophic oil spill that's threatened the Gulf. And even though the investigation is taking place underneath the water's surface, NPR's Carrie Johnson reports there's a lot going on at the Justice Department.
The Justice Department wants everyone to know it hasn't forgotten about the oil spill this year. Gary Grindler is the department's second in command, and he described the investigation this way.
This investigation is a very high priority for the Department of Justice, so senior officials up to the top are very involved.
Over the past several months, top-ranking justice officials, including Grindler, visited the Gulf to look at critical pieces of evidence, like the four-story high blowout preventer.
Tremendous number of resources are being devoted to this. There are at least 40 attorneys that are involved in both the civil division and the criminal side of the house. We have U.S. attorneys' offices along the Gulf that have been affected that are actively involved.
This investigation could be a long haul. The Justice Department has leased office space across the street from the courthouse in New Orleans. And inside those offices, prosecutors are going through documents and building a case. David Ullman used to be a prosecutor. These days he teaches at the University of Michigan, but he's closely following the oil spill investigation.
Proving that there was negligence on the criminal side, proving that there was an oil spill on the civil side, these are relatively easy matters for them to prove based on what we already know.
Ullman says criminal charges against BP and Transocean, which operated the rig, could be a foregone conclusion. The only real issue, he says, is how much the companies will pay to settle allegations they released oil into the Gulf. Ullman thinks charges are more likely against Halliburton, too, after a presidential commission found the company used faulty cement to seal the well. Investigators are also looking at the big picture, the corporate culture of BP, and how it may have foreshadowed the rig disaster.
And then the really big question mark is what will happen with individuals. If the Justice Department decides that there are individuals who should be charged, it's very likely that they would contest the charges because they could go to jail.
In the last 10 years, what we've seen is a tendency just to go with the corporate plea.
That's Jane Barrett. She's a former prosecutor.
In particular, the individuals that get charged are those who are affiliated with, you know, not your Fortune 200 companies, but smaller companies.
Barrett says it can be difficult to prove any one employee knows enough about safety problems to become the target of criminal charges. So difficult that the federal Justice Department never charged the captain of the Exxon Valdez with wrongdoing after that disaster. The new DOJ investigation could be complicated by another factor. Some of the managers on the oil rig already are invoking their rights to remain silent. But Grindler, the deputy attorney general, says authorities are considering every legal tool at their disposal.
There are a number of statutes that are clearly at play: the Clean Water Act, the Oil Pollution Act, the Migratory Bird Act, and the Endangered Species Act.
Experts say there's another law, too, the Seaman's Manslaughter Statute from the 1800s. Unlike most environmental laws, the Seaman's Statute allows the government to bring felony charges if workers on board a vessel, like the oil rig, die because of neglect from the ship captain or ship owner. In all, 11 men died on the Deepwater Horizon. Prosecutors are keeping the life rafts as evidence. And remember that crime scene security zone in the Gulf of Mexico? The judge says no one is supposed to touch it until October 2011, giving the Justice Department at least another year to plug away at its huge investigation. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
With the midterms behind him, President Obama is visiting the world's largest democracy today, India. When he and his team return to the U.S., they'll be undertaking a new strategy with a new Congress. We've been asking a variety of writers and thinkers to weigh in with their advice for President Obama, both from inside and beyond the proverbial beltway. We call it Memos to the President. And we start with novelist Walter Mosley, the man behind the E.Z. Rollins detective novels.
Mr. Obama, you do not need a magic bullet to fend off the hyenas, but a solid group of on-the-ground supporters that understand the problems and are willing to extol the virtues of your vision. You have to call on us, as you did getting elected. We have to heed that call. Walter Mosley.
Next, we hear from National Review columnist Catherine Jean Lopez.
Dear Mr. President, please join John Boehner in making the Hyde Amendment permanent and universal. No federal taxpayer funding of abortion, period. You and I don't have to agree on the morality of abortion to keep my money out of it. You would be getting us beyond the contentious appropriations debate we have every year, talking past one another. It would show that you respect the moral consciences of many Americans and that you don't view us as enemies. Thank you, Mr. President. Catherine Jean Lopez.
Finally, we head to the West Coast, to Berkeley, California. Here's food writer Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, with his memo to the president.
Dear Mr. President, with campaign charges of elitism still ringing in your ears, you can invite the Tea Partiers over to the White House for a conciliatory whole hog barbecue, but why not make that a pastured, antibiotic-free, sustainable hog? Not only will this advance your agenda for food system reform, but that pig will be so tasty, you just might win a few Republican converts to the cause. Bon appetit, Michael Pollan.
And you can find all of our memos to the president at npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.